Hi, my name is Craig Cook, Alicia's father. When Alicia was 14, she sent me a letter. She said she didn't want to have any part of me and that she wanted me to go away. I was living in Colorado with my second wife, Marcia, and our son, Cole, then 3. I won't deny that I was hurt when I read her words, but I also looked at what she was saying and the circumstances, and I understood where she was coming from. Did I rationalize why I wasn't around more? In some respects, yes. She was a teenager and already developing into who she was going to be, where Cole was still young. I also needed a tag team with his mother since we were both working for an airline. When one of us was leaving, the other was coming home, and getting to New York was a challenge. Yet, I cannot negate what Alicia was feeling. When she needed me, I wasn't there for her. I didn't respond to the letter, but I did say to myself, I'm not going anywhere.
3 things happened the year I turned 14. I started a friendship that would frame my world for more than a decade. I ended my relationship with Craig, and I stumbled my way onto the front porch of the music business, all before I was old enough to drive. The year was 1995, and New York City had become my concert hall. From Harlem to Bed-Stuy, Mount Vernon to Queens Village, my girl group and I took our harmonies directly to the streets, performing in parks and rec centers, schools and cafes, any place where we could draw an audience. During hip-hop's golden moment, music lived not just in us, but all around, wedged between the sidewalk cracks, reverberating through back alleys and brownstones, soaring up from neon-lit bodegas to mirrored high-rises. The city came most alive on summer weekends. Beatboxers laid down their freshest rhythms as onlookers whooped and wailed their approval. Showboaters rolled past the Apollo on 125th Street, blasting Biggie's thunderous bass lines from their car stereos. The electricity of it all crackled in the air. The Village was a major hotspot, a nightly playground for aspiring musicians and artists of every kind. There, late one evening, when my young ass probably should have been at home and in bed, a friend and I found our way into a cipher, a musical gathering right along 6th Avenue. Kalundi, my classmate and neighbor, but not a member of my girl group, hung with me a lot. Once at the inner ring of the circle, we both immediately recognized the rapper, this tall, caramel-colored cat known around town by his MC name, Crucial. He and his partner, the Quantum Leap, a killer beatboxer who was unmissably tall with long dreads, performed frequently near Washington Square Park. The two, as usual, rocked their freestyle show, and then the crowd dispersed. As Kalundi and I headed toward the train, I looked back to spot Crucial catching up to us. "I'm Kerry," he said, a little out of breath as he offered his real name. Kalundi and I exchanged a quick glance that said, "He's cute." "Nice rhymes," I said to him. He thanked me and then explained that he was on break from his job as a security guard at a parking lot a few blocks over where he worked the graveyard shift. "Can I call you?" he asked me as we parted. I suppressed the girlish smile threatening to spread across my face and gave him my beeper number. Kalundi and I walked over to the C train on 8th Avenue and headed uptown. That was around 10:30. I got off first at 42nd Street. Kalundi, who lived a bit farther north, stayed on an extra stop. My mother wasn't home that evening, but she, of course, expected me to be there by my 11 p.m. curfew. I made it in with only 1 minute to spare. That's when my beeper screen lit up with Kalundi's code 52, which was her street number. I froze. Why is she calling me so soon after I just saw her? Did she make it home okay? My hands trembled as I dialed her up, fearing what I'd hear on the other end of the receiver. "Hello?" said a baritone voice on the line. My heartbeat quickened. "Who's this?" I asked. "It's Kerry," I heard. "Remember we met tonight?" I stared at my beeper to be sure I'd seen the right number. I had. "What's your code?" I asked him. "It's 52," he told me. K, as in Kerry, was the number 5 on the keypad, he explained, and B, as in brothers, his last name, was 2. He and Colondia, turned out, had the same code, which seemed funny to me then, but perhaps was more providence than coincidence. Over the next hour, until I heard Mom's key turn in the lock, Kerry told me more of his story. Born in Brooklyn and raised between Harlem and Far Rockaway, he'd been dreaming of the MC life since the day he first heard Rapper's Delight banging from his radio. When he was 18, word spread that the producers at B-Boy Records were in search of new artists. Kerry and a friend showed up at the label with their hastily created VHS demo, and not long after, they signed a contract. The deal ultimately went south, but Kerry's passion for rap remained. By day, he sharpened the lyrics that village bystanders applauded. By night, he worked his security job as a way to keep the lights on until his next break came around. We found immediate common ground in our desire to one day share our creations with the world. Me, a classically trained pianist steeped in soul and R&B, and him, a striver with as much of a deep love for hip-hop as I've always had. No romance arose between us initially. From time to time over the next year, we'd catch up by phone, and as friends, we'd talk music and trade mixtapes, or when I was downtown, I'd occasionally swing by his security guard booth and chill. "Sing me something," he said to me one evening after I told him about my latest performance with the girls. In the cold night air, I cleared my throat, drew in a breath, and belted out the opening notes of "Been So Long," the Anita Baker hit. Kerry stared at me so intently that I stopped singing after the first line. "Yo, if I was a record exec," he finally said, "I'd sign you right here on the spot." I blushed and did not finish the song. The chemistry was thickening, but I contained it. For one thing, as grown as I thought I was, I knew Kerry was out of my age range. The first time we spoke, he mentioned he was 24, 5 years older than he looked to me. He, of course, also asked my age, and I told him I was 17, rather than the 14 that I actually was. Given that I roamed around the village so late, my proclamation must have rung true. Kerry had also told me he had a young son, a revelation that placed him squarely in a life season beyond my own. Though he and his ex had parted ways, he was determined to raise and provide for his child. He eventually squeezed in a third job as a UPS mail handler. In ways that I'd come to understand only years later, Kerry's commitment to fatherhood is in large part what drew me so powerfully toward him. He represented the deep dependability that I yearned for in my relationship with Craig. It has been said that a girl grows up to choose a man who either bears a striking resemblance to her father or one who is nothing like him. Both choices are, at their core, reactions. In my view then, Kerry was not only Craig's opposite, he also served as a salve for the wound created by my father's absence. A sore spot that in those days I was not aware I was nursing. By the time I turned 15, our connection had evolved from friendship to relationship, and I worked up the nerve to ask my mother if Kerry and I could go out on a date. "I need to meet him first so I can tell the police what he looks like in case you don't come home," she told me. When he stopped by our crib that evening to take me to dinner, my mother's breezy conversation and occasional smile told me she approved of his gentlemanly manners. She, of course, had no clue how old he was or that he had a son, and surprisingly, her inner attorney didn't think to ask him his age. Kerry could have passed for being anywhere from 17 to 25. By spring of 1996, after months of dreaming and connecting with each other, I decided that it was time for me to tell Kerry the truth. Sort of. "You know how I said I was 17 when we first met?" I casually brought up one afternoon. He nodded. "Well, I was really 16. I said. Before he could respond, I quickly added, but I'm 17 now. Also not true. The original lie had slid so easily from my tongue that it couldn't have been the first time I told it. And every time I'd aged myself up, others seemed to believe me. I had the face of a teenager, yes, but my womanly curves whispered a different tale. I'd, of course, fooled around with boys my age, but in truth, most of them felt like exactly that to me, boys. I'd grown up having to hold my own in disagreements with one of the sharpest women on the planet. That gave me early entree into the universe of adult reasoning, and it also made me bored with young men close to my age. And given my grade skipping, I always felt older than I was. From Carrie's viewpoint, my false claims seemed to square up with my life stage. He knew I was near the end of high school. What senior is not at least 17 or almost 18? To be any younger, I would have had to have skipped two grades, which Carrie had no idea I'd done. I cared more about watering the roots of our connection than I cared about our age difference. So I kept on distorting the truth for months until circumstances would later yank the wig right off my bald head. The letter I sent to my father began not with Dear Dad or even Dear Craig, but simply with the date in the upper left-hand corner, 7/10/94. It saddens me that most of my heart is bitter towards you, I wrote. It's only that little part that feels sad, that's not bitter. All I want is for you to mind your own business. I don't want the phone calls, I don't want the letters, I don't want the fake acts you pull to try and make me think you care. I don't want anything. By the time those words rolled from the tip of my pen and onto my notebook paper, my longing for my father had hardened into resentment. My mother still recalls the many times when Craig said he'd fly in to see me, but for reasons unknown to me then, he did not show up. I'd sit beside the window in our living room, looking down over the terrace to see if I could glimpse him arriving. An hour or so after the appointed time, the phone would ring, and I would overhear my mother, in hushed tones in her bedroom, saying, "Okay, I understand." Moments later, she'd emerge into the living room with disappointment etched on her forehead as she announced, "He can't make it." That was it. Conversation over. Expectations, once again, dashed. When I did see Craig, it was often at Nana's house. Just as he'd done after I was born, Craig stepped through my grandmother's doorframe cradling Cole before gently handing him to his mother so she could bond with her new grandbaby. In fact, it had been Cole's birth that drew me back toward Craig after our connection had grown strained. To his credit, my father seemed intent on ensuring that Cole and I would grow up knowing each other. So in the first 2 years of my brother's life, I saw Craig a little more frequently than I ever had. "This is Cole," he said when he introduced me to the tiny, precious human being who immediately clasped his miniature pink fingers around my thumb. I wanted to be in my brother's life as much as I'd wanted Craig to be a more consistent participant in my own. If I pushed Cole away because of my difficult relationship with my father, I reasoned, that would have made me exactly like him. Yet by my freshman year of high school, the gash I'd sustained was freshly sliced open. Mom was enduring a particularly stressful financial season, and even with the blessing of an affordable apartment, she often found herself short on rent. We regularly danced along the knife edge of solvency, while Craig, on the other side of the country, nurtured and provided for his wife and other child. Craig now explains that he, too, was then struggling in a paycheck-to-paycheck existence and couldn't help us as much as he wanted to, but it wasn't his money that I most desired. It was a sense of his concern and caring. Mommy took on additional work that often kept her away from the apartment for long stretches. That left me, a latchkey kid, with plenty of time to contemplate Craig's whereabouts while seated at the piano, emptying my soul into bluesy jazz compositions. On the afternoon that I picked up my pen and paper and began my letter to him, I'd grown weary of the promises not kept. The last-minute cancellations, the long silences between the annual birthday cards. I sat at our small table and I finally wrote out, in bubble cursive, exactly what I felt. I then carefully tore off the frayed edges along the perforations, folded the paper in half, shoved it in an envelope, and slid it into the slot of a blue mailbox. Craig didn't answer my letter. My father in those days was more of a pacifist than a fighter. Confrontation was not in his nature, which may be one reason he and my mother, seldom one to back down from a brawl, were attracted to each other from opposite ends of the personality spectrum. But Craig says he had no intention of allowing me to push him off the ledge of our relationship. He says he attempted to stay connected from the back row of my life, often checking in with Nana to hear the latest on what was happening with me. Even after I mailed those divorce papers to Craig, some part of me must have hoped he'd fight to stay in my life. But at 14, I felt sure I never wanted to hear from him again. We called ourselves Ambition, our cutesy teenage take on the idea of striving, of catapulting ourselves from New York's boulevards onto center stage in the music business. My friends Tanisha and Natalia were around 16 when we formed our girl group, and just as in my first group, I was the youngin' at 14. Our a cappella selections made us sound more like En Vogue, the fierce foursome that emerged in the 90s, than we did like my original blueprint, the Jackson 5. I now understand that trying to be the next anyone is as foolish as it sounds. The shoes you dream of filling have already been worn ragged through their soles. You've got to step into your own kicks and just do you. What I lacked in age, I made up for with experience. In the years since I made my preschool debut as a brown-skinned Dorothy, I'd swiftly moved through my classical training and onto composition. I wrote my first song when I was 12, after losing my dear Fafa. I hadn't been there on the day he passed away, but when I later heard that an ambulance had to be called multiple times before help arrived, that news nearly broke me. Not long after we lost him, I saw the movie Philadelphia. There's a moving scene in which Tom Hanks' character Andrew Beckett, a lawyer suffering with AIDS, narrates a stirring aria. Maria Callas's La Mamma Morta from the opera Andrea Chenier. I seldom cry in movies, but during that 10 p.m. show, both my mother and me bawled our eyes out. When I returned home from the theater after midnight, I sat down at my piano and I wrote my first song called I'm All Alone. Though it was way past my bedtime, Mom allowed me to stay at the piano as long as I wanted. Creating, she understood, was my way of grieving. My grandfather in his death left me with a treasure I've carried with me through life. His memory opened up in me an emotional vault I hadn't even known existed, and what poured out was a deluge of lyrics. I sit here all alone, and I wonder what is wrong. Why are there so many deaths? So many lost survivors. My early compositions clearly weren't all that deep, but they came from a real place. My first experiences of longing, of heartache and anguish and love, they have a certain vibrancy to them, a passion and immediacy that pale in life's later rounds. The magic in any art is not only in its technique, but in its authenticity. Truth in its rawest form is what resonates most powerfully. Penning my first song became another step in my quest to find my musical footing, my own flow. I'd already graduated from mimicking other artists to attempting to create my own vibe. Even still, I drew inspiration from the musical geniuses in my mother's record collection, as well as the collection I'd started for myself. I studied every note of Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, the white cassette tape that I played until it fell apart. It blew me away each time I heard it. I admired how artists like Marvin and Nina Simone stayed in tune with their political times, how their music reflected and defined the spirit of change. I dreamed of one day doing the same with a sound I was only beginning to define. By 1994, that sound had taken the form of the harmonies I'd composed for Ambition. One day that summer, my girls and I rehearsed our show at Harlem's Police Athletic League, the PAL. I rounded out the performance with my piano rendition of Butterflies, one of my earliest compositions and my first love song. Tanisha's Uncle Greg had arranged our rehearsal. He and another friend of his had been helping us refine our show. On this afternoon at PAL, Conrad Robinson, a vocal coach who oversaw a youth program in the Bronx, had been invited by Greg to hear us perform. "Did you write these songs?" he asked me afterward. I nodded and smiled. "Listen," he said, "maybe we can start doing a little work together to polish up your set." Once outside the building, the girls and I high-fived and gushed. If Conrad was asking to work with us, maybe we really had something. I didn't know it at the time, and it's probably best that I didn't, because I truly might have lost my teenage mind. But Conrad was the brother of R&B manager Jeff Robinson, whose connections ran deep and wide throughout the entertainment world. After weeks of Conrad and Greg helping us fine-tune our pitches, Conrad had called Jeff. "Man, you gotta come see these girls," he told him. Jeff, who'd heard that refrain one too many times, didn't exactly race to our next showcase, but Conrad persisted. Probably just to get his brother off his back, Jeff at last stopped in at the PAL and, unbeknownst to us, took a seat in the back of the room. We launched into our first song, Groove Theory's Tell Me, complete with its large dose of swag, and then ended the way we always did, with me at the piano. Afterward, Conrad and Jeff approached us. "I want you to meet my brother," Conrad said, introducing Jeff. "He works in the music biz." We each shook hands, and I tried to play it cool, though my heart was hammering away in my chest. "That was good," was all Jeff said. In fact, he was so understated that it immediately dampened my excitement. But then, as we were preparing to leave, Jeff pulled me aside. "Come with me and we'll make millions," he whispered. It was a statement as effusive as it was unexpected. My eyes filled with light, but then quickly dimmed as a realization took root. He wasn't extending an invitation to all three of us. He was singling me out. That was the start of Jeff's campaign for me to go solo. "You need to be on your own," he told me later. "You can sing, you can play, you can compose. You're the whole package." I was stunned and flattered. What artist wouldn't be gratified by such an affirmation? One I'd longed to hear in the years since that tattered upright slid across our doorway. But I didn't feel ready to go out on my own. The group thing was all I'd known. It was comfortable. At 14, I hadn't yet developed the muscle required to push past my zone of familiarity and into new and frightening territory. I still had it in my head that I would break onto the scene as Little Allie, and only after me and the girls reached stardom might I moonwalk out, Michael style, and claim my own stage. Through my eyes at the time, the solo life looked lonely. No friends with me on the road, no fam around to have my back, no fun. "You're wrong," Jeff kept telling me. I repeated my hesitation, and he finally left me with a choice. "Call me when you're ready." That sentence is what drove me to push our girl group to the next level. The truth is that our harmonies weren't as tight as they could have been. We were flat. We were sharp. We were, at times, totally off key. We worked harder than ever under the guidance of Conrad and Greg, as well as a few musicians we brought in. And though that effort lifted our game by an inch or two, we were still miles away from where we needed to be. We were eager, yes, but we were complete amateurs in a business in which the seeds of potential mastery serve as the entrance requirement. So we doubled up on our rehearsals and doubled down on our chords. And then, when Greg helped us arrange an audition with a record exec, who I pray doesn't remember me, we didn't land on a single one of our chords. I wanted so badly to make the group happen. We dreamed our dream in unison, and the thought of us disbanding made me wilt inside. But what's true in the music industry is also the case in life. Growth requires movement, and often the only way forward is through an exit door. Soon after our failed audition, I rang Jeff. "I'm ready," were the only words I spoke into the receiver. Within months of that declaration, I found myself near the top floor of a glistening skyscraper, an uncertain future stretched before me. Chapter 4, Columbia.
Hi, I go by the name of Kerry Crucial Brothers. After Alicia moved out of her mother's place in Hell's Kitchen, we lived together in a one-bedroom walk-up in Harlem. I was hustling together, jobs by day, and at night, Alicia and I had jam sessions. At first, I just had a keyboard and a drum machine. Then after she got a record deal, I was like, yo, we should buy some equipment. We went down to Sam Ash and got everything we needed. We turned the bedroom into our studio. The acoustics are better in a small closed-off space. We use nails and tape to put blankets on the walls and comforters on the ceiling for soundproofing. Until the early hours of the morning, we were in there jamming and vibing and listening to the greats, from Stevie Wonder and Nina Simone to Aretha Franklin and Curtis Mayfield. We were like, how come our music sounds so thin? We studied the credits on Stevie's records and were like, man, these guys are layering. They've got a Wurlitzer, an electric piano. We bought this rolling rack mount with all these sounds you can trigger with a keyboard. And sure enough, when we turned it on, we were like, look, we got a Wurlitzer. That's how we got into making our music sound fuller, by trial and error.
I just played out my soul on a marble white Baby Grand, the most gorgeous piano I'd ever seen. To my right stood Jeff, my manager, and a row of Columbia Records top brass, Tommy Mottola, Donnie Ina, Michael Malden. To my left stood the city that raised me, sparkling anew through pristine floor-to-ceiling windows looking down over Madison Avenue. "If we can close the deal," Donnie said to Jeff, "she can have the piano. I'll give you 15 minutes to talk it over." Without another word, Donnie strode out of the room. This wasn't my first audition. Just before my 15th birthday in January 1996, I'd at last teamed up with Jeff, who got to work on attempting to land me a solo deal with one of the top labels. Jeff immediately connected me with his longtime friend and colleague, Peter Edge, then an artist development executive at Warner Brothers Records. Peter was excited about my prospects in the music business, but he was also in transition. Years later, I'd learned that by the time he met me, he was already planning to leave Warner Brothers to work with Clive Davis at Arista. After watching me perform, he wanted to sign me, but after he'd fully transitioned into his new role at Arista. Meanwhile, I forged ahead with work on a demo, one that could be distributed to various record labels. Even as we put together my sample and sent it around town, I was performing. Though I was mostly appearing in talent shows and events around my neighborhood, I also set out on the road. I played all around the tri-state area, sometimes even in venues where I would have otherwise been turned away at the entrance. I was too young to drink, but apparently old enough to put on a show for the partiers who gathered nightly. By spring of 1997, Jeff had lined up several showcases, private sessions where record label heads could see me perform live and on my own. No band, no backup singers, no soundtracks. Just me and my quivering hands on a piano, weaving together my best original songs alongside the elaborate compositions of Chopin and Bach. At every showcase, I played my music like it was the only chance I'd ever get to land a contract because, in my view, it was. Coming from a place where the sense of struggle lingers as strong as the smell of piss, I'd grown up seeing life through a single lens, survival. And from that vantage point, opportunity is never a promise. Rather, it is a hope and a powerful hustle, the kind I watched my mother keep up year after year. As I saw it, these showcases were my potential way out, my passport to a different existence. My passion must have resonated. Within days of my series of performances, every label executive had expressed interest. I was a musical combination they'd seldom witnessed. A classically trained pianist with Stevie-inspired cornrows, a fresh face with an old spirit, and a neo-soul sound reminiscent of the 70s. Jeff, eager to maximize our payday, created a bidding war. Peter, ultimately, did not bid. After we'd pulled together my demo and began meeting with various labels, things had moved so quickly that Peter hadn't yet made the transition to Arista, and he didn't want to sign me to Warner Brothers, only to abandon me shortly after. Many made offers, and Columbia made the most lucrative one. That's when Michael Maldon invited me to Columbia's stunning, marble-floored offices for a final performance and perhaps a chance to cement a deal. Jeff, a savvy businessman from the Bronx, had his gaze fixed on the financial opportunity. So did I. Yet I also had one wandering eye on a prize that felt just as important to me as the overall contract terms. That luxurious baby grand, which had to be worth more than $25,000. In fact, the moment Donnie mentioned that it could be mine, I began visualizing my mother and me moving out my dented upright and making space in our living room for this beauty. Jeff cut my daydream short. "We can't make a deal for no freaking piano," he said after Donnie was out of earshot. Even before I had a chance to launch into my plea, he decoded what was written all over my face. I would have signed just about any contract in order to claim this gem right in front of me. Donnie might as well have been dangling the Winston Blue Diamond in my face. That's just how enticing this piano was. In my state of deep salivation, I laid out for Jeff all the reasons I had to have this piano. "It's crazy, Allie," he kept telling me. "No way." A week later, I signed the contract, not just for that piano, but I'll admit it did sway me. In addition to the baby grand, the label executives also offered us the highest advance, a fact that pleased Jeff as much as it did me and my mother. And Donnie ultimately kept his promise to give me a new piano, though not the one I'd played that day. A baby grand of the same brand was delivered long after my deal was done. By then, the music business had already begun teaching me its first pair of lessons. Always study the fine print in your contract. And after you've negotiated the best possible deal for yourself, buy your own damn piano. In the spring of 1997, I graduated as class valedictorian from the Professional Performing Arts School. I gave some cringe-worthy speech about teachers trying to box you in and tell you who to be. In one hand, I held my diploma and a scholarship to Columbia University. In the other hand, I clutched a newly signed label contract that would change my course in ways I couldn't have anticipated. And among the crowd of proud parents, relatives, and friends gathered for the ceremony, there stood my steady boyfriend, a man who still had no idea I wasn't old enough to vote. If I thought I was grown at 14, by 16, my mother couldn't tell me anything. Mom was as forthright and impassioned as she'd always been. What changed was me. As I grew out of my natural introversion and into my voice, I challenged her in every regard. At all hours, I ran around the city with Kerry. I ignored Mom's incessant messages on my beeper, along with her demands that I check in with her regularly. I was still technically a minor, but circumstances had prematurely edged me into purgatory, that transition away from the dependence of adolescence and toward the autonomy of adulthood. The record deal had already given me financial liberation, and I longed for every other freedom that I thought went along with that. I wanted to roam the streets from the village to Harlem whenever I felt like it. I wanted to spend my nights in the arms of Kerry, never pausing to wonder whether I'd blown past my curfew. And yet I also still wanted the comforts of my childhood, a stocked refrigerator, a mother whose very presence gave me a deep sense of stability, the solid grounding I felt each time I walked through our apartment door. In essence, I longed for two mutually exclusive realities, inextricable connection and full-fledged self-reliance. Rather than reconciling those two existences, I leapt into a new one. A few weeks after I graduated, I moved into Kerry's rent-controlled apartment near 137th Street and Malcolm X Boulevard. My mother, of course, didn't approve. She had every legal ability to stop me. In fact, because I was still under 18, she'd had to co-sign my record contract. And yet, as much as Mom did not want me to go, she wisely anticipated what I see so vividly in retrospect. Forcing me to stay would have widened the chasm between us. In a sense, I'd purchased my freedom with a contract and a six-figure advance. She understood that and just let me go. Soon after I moved, the truth about my age finally came spilling out. One afternoon, I was venting with Jeff about a conflict I had with my mom. Though I was no longer under her roof, she still had plenty to say about how I should manage my life and career. "You know you can go to court and be emancipated as a minor," Jeff told me. Kerry, who was standing next to me, stared at Jeff. "What do you mean, emancipated as a minor?" he asked. "Why would she need to do that?" Later that evening at the apartment, I came clean. "You know how I told you I was 17 when we met? And then later I said I was 16? He looked at me but didn't say anything. "I was really 14, I admitted. Silence. Kerry was understandably upset that I'd misled him. For a few days, we even stopped speaking, but the truth hung thick in the air. After 2 amazing years together, there was too much love between us to turn around. I'd always felt capable as a student, even when, during high school, I was balancing my performing arts curriculum with my academic one. The work was manageable. The A's in English and French and trigonometry flowed as easily for me as my daily practice at the piano. That all changed when I enrolled at Columbia University. Mom had always insisted that I go to college, just as she had. I'd grown up expecting that I'd one day apply. She was adamant about excellence in education. During our initial meetings with the team at Columbia Records, she'd often find a way to pipe in with, "And when Alicia finishes her studies..." Jeff and everyone else in the room would silently gaze at her like she just suggested I fly to Jupiter. No one wanted to cross my mother by stating the obvious. Working as a full-time musician while keeping up with a rigorous Ivy League curriculum is about as easy as giving birth while enduring a root canal. And yet I was up for the challenge. Like my mom, I saw the value in a traditional education, and given how good of a student I'd always been, I actually looked forward to my time on campus. I also knew I'd never hear the end of it if I chose not to enroll. As a liberal arts major, I started with a full course load, and I felt overwhelmed practically from week 1. Professors assigned an enormous amount of reading, sometimes hundreds of pages a week. My plan was to attend all my classes during the day and then stay on top of the reading while en route to my evening studio sessions. There I'd sit on a train, doing my best to concentrate on long passages of Homer's Odyssey, while struggling to hold my book steady and keep my eyes open. The New York City subway has to rank as one of the worst places in the world to focus. It's noisy, it stinks, and seemingly at every stop, a street musician rolls in, attempting to earn a little applause and enough tips for a meal. I usually did more ogling or dozing than I did studying. I'd then get to the studio at around 6 p.m. and stay until 2 or 3 a.m. Later that same morning, in my 11 o'clock class, I'd be in the back row, half asleep with my hoodie over my forehead. What are they even talking about? I'd think as my classmates discussed the homework. Please don't let this professor call on me. I was a total wreck. I was too exhausted to recall the little I'd managed to read, and nothing was computing. I also felt incredibly lonely. Kerry, as usual, was juggling multiple jobs, and our schedules didn't always align. I'd stop in at my mother's place only to find she was out, probably working overtime or enjoying her new season as an empty nester. She'd been away from the apartment a lot when I was younger, and in those days, I'd relished my silence and alone time at the piano. But during this new chapter of my life, a time when I first felt truly on my own, the ground beneath me seemed shaky. It didn't help that I was facing the enormous responsibility of making a record, a task I had no idea how to even begin. A few weeks into my courses, I reached for a lifeline. I made an appointment to talk with my dean in her office. "So I have this record deal," I told her, "and I'm also trying to get through my program here." "And how's all that working out?" she asked gently, as if she knew the answer. "Well," I said, "not that great." Tears welled up in my eyes, but I managed to hold them back. "It's tough to get everything done." She nodded sympathetically. "You know, Alicia," she said, "Columbia will always be here." I stared at her, but didn't respond, mostly because I was surprised. I'd expected her to convince me to stay at Columbia. "And if you decide to invest your energy into music full time," she continued, "you could always come back." For a week after I left my dean's office, I wrestled with my decision. The thought of disappointing my mother broke my heart. I'd wanted to prove to her and to myself that I could balance college and a career on stage. And yet, in a sense, I'd already chosen my path years earlier when I entered Miss Hazel's magical world of song. From that moment on, music had grabbed hold of me and never put me down. On the afternoon when I signed my record deal, I was so elated, I almost could not speak. That evening, I lay awake staring up at the ceiling and thinking, this is really happening for me. After a childhood of dreaming and praying for some way, any way, into the music industry, that dream was now firmly in my grasp. And now that I had the opportunity, it scared me. What if I fail? Musicians often spend years toiling away at their craft, playing in small venues and hoping to get discovered and signed. Most never do. And here I was at just 16, with a yellow brick road in front of me. Yes, the thought of telling my mother that I might leave Columbia scared me. But what frightened me more was squandering a chance I might never again get. My conversation with the dean gave me the courage to do what I dreaded. Appear before the bench of Chief Justice Argello. If I was going to leave Columbia, I knew I had to present a watertight case to my mother. I spent days thinking through my best arguments and writing down what I'd say. I then called my mother and asked her if she could do lunch. She happily agreed. I chose a restaurant in Hell's Kitchen, this Italian spot that was usually crowded. If Mom got upset, I reasoned, she'd likely restrain herself in such a public setting. When my mother arrived at the appointed time, I was already there waiting. We began with a general catch-up before the conversation shifted into second gear. I pulled out my paper, carefully unfolded it, and laid it out on the table. "So, school is pretty hard," I began. "Hard?" she said, wrinkling her brow. "What do you mean, hard? You graduated at the top of your high school class." I fidgeted with the paper. "With being in the studio at night," I explained, "and then trying to keep up with my classes, I'm not coping that well. It's difficult to concentrate on both school and music. I spoke to the dean. Mommy laid down her fork. You spoke to the dean about what? I mean, the dean, and she said that maybe it's better for me to just do music and come back to school later. Mom glared at me. And why is that a good idea? She asked, the volume of her voice rising with each syllable. A few people glanced over at us, and I looked back down at my paper in search of my next justification. Don't you think you need a strong education in order to excel at what you're doing in the music business? Well, yes, I whispered in an attempt to take down Mom's temperature, but I could get going with what I'm doing musically and then return to Columbia. And what makes you think you'll ever get back around to that? I didn't have a good answer to that question, nor did our conversation have a definitive conclusion. I'm sure my mother was as displeased about my choice to leave Columbia as she'd been about my move out of her apartment, but just as she'd done in the latter case, she set aside the reins and let me charge ahead. As a creative spirit herself, she'd tell me years later, she understood my predicament. I could not take on two major pursuits without significantly compromising at least one of them. I don't believe in regret, so I never look back on my choice to leave Columbia and wish that things had turned out differently. Life's current was so obviously carrying me in the direction of music, and rather than trying to swim back upstream, I simply let the tide carry me forward. At the time, I wouldn't have described it that way, nor did I truly understand that there was a flow with my name on it. But from this side of life, I can see how every moment, every experience, every pivot, even my supposed missteps, have been life's way of getting me where I've always been meant to go. Rather than resisting the current, I've learned to surrender. You need a different last name, Michael Mauldin said to me in his thick Southern accent. Michael, the father of artist and producer Jermaine Dupri, and then president of Columbia Records Urban Division, had been the one to sign me. Choose something memorable, he told me. I had no idea what I'd call myself, but this I knew for sure. Alicia Argello Cook doesn't exactly roll off the tongue. I spent a week brainstorming names, but made little progress. So I reached for a dictionary and I scrolled through every entry from A to Z in search of any word that might make a great last name. Alicia Anchovy? Nope. Alicia Monopoly? Try again. By the time I got to the last few letters of the alphabet, I was desperate. What about Alicia Wild? I asked my mom one evening. Sounds like a stripper's name, she said bluntly. She was right. A few days later, Michael checked in with me to find out what I'd come up with. Nada. I have an idea for you, he told me. Last night I had this dream, and I couldn't find the keys to my briefcase. I was looking everywhere for those keys because I really needed to get into my case to get some documents. This morning, I woke up with one word on my mind. Keys. What do you think about Alicia Keys? I smiled. Keys, I said slowly. Alicia Keys. Right away, it felt natural to me, as if it had always been my name. It just fit. It, of course, also hinted at the piano, a defining feature of my performances, and keys open doors. I love it, I told Michael. Let's use it. The new name slid right into position. The early months of producing the album, however, didn't go quite so smoothly. When I had signed my contract that spring, I was over the moon. By summer, I'd crashed back down to earth as I grappled with the reality that I was clueless about how to make a record. A contract with a label is an open doorway, and what no one tells you is that once you step through that door, you're mostly on your own. No grooming, no weekly team meetings, no general artistic direction. It's just you and a few producers trying to pull off a feat that frightened me to my core. At 16, I had no idea how to create a commercially viable album. I plunged right into writing with a couple of established producers. That collaboration quickly veered off the rails. During our studio sessions, I'd bring in some new lyrics and play them with a piano composition I'd been refining. "It needs to be more upbeat, less piano-driven," I'd hear after delivering a few measures. Less piano-driven? Did he know anything about me? Other times, the producers would attempt to write lyrics for me. The material didn't reflect my truth or perspective. There was a total disconnect between who I was as an artist and what I was bringing to the table musically. When I pushed back, the label execs responded by sending in a revolving cast of producers. None of them was any better for me. The low point came when one evening after a session, a producer approached me with a question on his lips and something hard poking through the crotch of his jeans. "Yo, you want to meet me at my house later?" he asked. I didn't even bother responding to that foolishness. I just brushed it off and kept moving. Meanwhile, I was hearing the same weekly refrain from Columbia. "Where's the music?" For months, I set out for the studio with dread in my chest, feeling disgusted with the process and unsure of myself. There was no way I could do my best work in that frame of mind, surrounded by producers who were so busy trying to push up on me that they couldn't effectively partner with me. I had to find my own path forward. It's not that my efforts had produced nothing, just not nearly enough. I'd hammer out lyrics while in the studio with the producers and then attempt to forge ahead on my own. I always made the most progress at home in the makeshift studio Carrie and I had created. Using all that equipment I'd purchased with my advance, the two of us would often be up until sunrise, vibing and jamming and just enjoying the music. There was a freedom and a playfulness in the air. That's because we were creating simply for the love of the process. Our partnership as musicians felt as magical and unexpected to me as our personal connection always had. So several months after I'd signed with Columbia, I asked Kerry to be my producing partner. He agreed and set aside his other work to collaborate with me. That move was one of the smartest I've ever made, because from then on, the music just flowed. Kerry, who'd already taught himself a lot about the intricacies of producing, invested his full passion into mastering the best techniques. Our occasional jam sessions blossomed into nightly improvisations that surely put us on thin ice with the neighbors. We were super serious. Once it was time to begin work at 6 p.m. sharp, all beepers and cell phones were turned off. Then for 6 hours straight, we'd lose ourselves in a shared intention, creating music powerful enough to move us as well as all others who heard it. Our home sessions were just stage one. Once we had a couple of great songs going, Jeff would book us time at an actual studio where we'd have the complete range of equipment. We'd sometimes bring in bass guitarists or drummers so we could record them and later weave in their creations alongside my piano and voice soundtracks. Thanks to a mother who taught me the twin D's of success, discipline, and diligence, I lived and breathed my work. I may not have known exactly how to complete an album, but I knew how to focus. I also knew how to write from my soul, my center. Every song we produced was an expression of some aspect of life through my eyes. Both Jeff and Michael Malden, who'd been in favor of my evolution toward working on my own, loved what they heard. In the summer of 1998, my album was nearly complete, or so I thought, because by this time, Columbia had undergone a major staff shakeup. Michael Malden, my greatest advocate, was gone, and the label was now headed by a new set of executives. "What's this?" one of the label heads asked Jeff after he'd heard my music. "I mean, it's kind of soulful, but where are the pop smashes, the radio hits? This sounds like a demo." That shift in expectations began with my music and extended to my public image. They wanted my massive curls blown straight and flowing down my back. They wanted me to lose weight. They wanted my hemline shorter, my teeth whiter, my cleavage on full display. They wanted me, the tomboy from Hell's Kitchen, to become the next teen pop idol. In short, they wanted to alter my entire identity. A record label is a marketing machine. Behind its doors, fledgling artists are crafted into whatever image the label's execs believe they can sell. And what was selling in the late 90s? Female pop stars like Whitney Houston, Mariah Carey, and Janet Jackson. Most label executives aren't all that interested in artistic innovation. It's not about carving out a niche, it's about shoving an artist into an existing one. Commercial success, not imagination, is the primary goal. There's nothing wrong with being a pop princess, it's just not who I am. Trouble was, no one quite knew what to do with a piano prodigy in cornrows, mixing classical music with hip-hop beats and bass lines alongside a dash of gospel. We can help you get a more radio-friendly sound, the new leaders of Columbia told me. But it was too late for that. The genie hadn't just escaped the bottle. She was already way down the street and around the corner. I'd gotten used to doing things my way, on my terms, during my private jam sessions with Kerry. No way was I going back into the studio with one of the label's recommended producers. When I heard that my album had been referred to as a demo, it was soul-crushing. I felt as if someone had just called my precious newborn ugly. "This'll work out," Kerry kept trying to reassure me as I spiraled into a depression so deep I couldn't pry myself out of bed for weeks. "Don't give up." Meanwhile, Jeff and the attorneys we brought in tried to work out a compromise with Columbia. To Jeff's credit, he stood strongly in my corner at a moment when many other managers would have bolted, or worse, pressured me to get in line with the label's vision. "If they don't get who you are," he told me, "then we'll just find someone who does." That began the battle for me to get back the master rights to my own work. Rights I had relinquished back when I thought Columbia was my dream home. "Just let us have our masters back and we'll go," Jeff and my lawyers argued to the executives. But they would not budge, even though they apparently hated what I'd produced. I didn't want to walk away without my music. Doing so would have given Columbia a financial stake in any of my future profits. The label also would have been able to license my master recordings to third parties for placement in television shows or films, for instance, without my consent. Most artists, and especially new ones, sign away their master rights because that's the price you pay for an on-ramp into the business. That's exactly what happened to a whole generation of Motown artists, many of whom sold millions of hit albums yet ended up flat broke because they didn't own their creations. Labels are not in the business of selling rights. They're in the business of acquiring them and then holding on to them tightly. Maybe I didn't yet own my music, but I would always be in control of my voice, my image, my actions and intentions, the person and artist I am at my core. And I'm the girl who spent hours with my head bowed over the keys of a secondhand upright, praying I'd one day get to share my creations with the world. I am the girl who wore my tough exterior as proudly as I did my soft heart. I am the girl who sported hoodies in place of sequined dresses, Tim's in place of stilettos. If I betrayed that girl, if I sold myself out by succumbing to the label's vision of who I should be, I might have been an extraordinary success, but I would have also been utterly miserable. I would have been up there on some stage singing songs I truly didn't believe in. I would have been living someone else's dream instead of celebrating my own. For me, that sacrifice was unthinkable. My fight to leave Columbia Records was my first major act of artistic defiance and a deeply personal one. Late one evening, while alone in the apartment, I turned down the world's volume and tuned into the whisper of my spirit. That deep inner knowing, that quiet voice and inkling I believe we all have. I knew my answer. Each of us usually does, but the calls for us to conform are nearly overpowering. They come in the form of a ballet teacher who demands a tucked in behind, or a classmate who throws shade at thick thighs and a curly fro. We adjust ourselves to fit, to adapt to others' ideas of who we should be. We shift ourselves, not in sweeping pivots, but in movements so tiny that they are hardly perceptible, even in our view. Years can pass before we finally discover that, after handing over our power piece by small piece, we no longer even look like ourselves. Even if I couldn't retrieve my master copyrights, I told Jeff, I wanted to somehow break free from Columbia. I might have to start over and create an entirely new album in order to completely cut the ties, but so be it. At least my music and my image would be authentic to me. At least I would still recognize my own reflection in the mirror. Chapter 5, Transitions. I was late. Jeff, who was already in the Arista Records lobby when I came sprinting and huffing through the front door, had arranged for us to meet with Clive Davis, the renowned music man with the golden touch, the legend who launched the careers of greats like Janis Joplin, Whitney Houston, Carlos Santana, and Bruce Springsteen, the label executive who, on this afternoon in 1998, had agreed to sit down with my tardy ass. The gathering was scheduled for 3 p.m., When I came whirling in at 3:15, out of breath and full of excuses, Jeff stood there, arms folded, wearing a frown that shouted, "Do you know what the hell is at stake?" I did, which is exactly why I'd taken some extra time to pick out my best outfit. I don't recall what I wore that day, but I do know that, after a major subway delay and a cab stuck in traffic, I got lucky. Clive, it turned out, was also running behind schedule. Peter Edge, by this time the head of Arista's Artist and Repertoire A&R division, had been the one to connect us with Clive. When my relationship with Columbia spiraled downhill, Jeff began exploring other possible partnerships for me around the industry. He gave a recording of some of my songs to Peter, who then handed it off to Clive, his boss. Clive was intrigued enough by what he heard to agree to a meeting and a short audition. "Come right in," Clive said, extending his hand to both Jeff and me. Clive, or Mr. Davis, as I respectfully called him then, offered us a seat and launched right into his story as if the three of us were longtime friends, sitting around at a barbecue in someone's backyard. Though impeccably dressed, that man is sharp. Suit and tie, matching hanky poking out of his jacket pocket. Clive came off more like a favorite uncle than the stuffy mogul one might expect. I, with my jaw on the ground and my heart palpitating, heard little of what he initially said. All I could do was gawk. Walking into Clive's office felt like stepping into a time capsule of music history. All over his walls, in row after row of perfectly positioned frames, hung photos of the scores of musical masters whose paths had intersected with his own. Patti Smith, Earth, Wind & Fire, The Grateful Dead, Simon & Garfunkel, Barry Manilow, Biggie, and Puffy, on and on. Many of these artists Clive had personally discovered. All had in some way been touched by his leadership and brilliance. Just sitting across from Clive in this space where so much magic had happened filled me with awe. "Peter showed me a video of one of your performances," Clive said, pulling my attention back to earth. "Your music is special." "Me? You talking about my music?" Moments later, right there on the piano in Clive's office, I put on my best show for an audience of one. I strung together most of the songs I'd written, pouring my soul into every refrain. You only get one chance to impress music's all-time most celebrated hitmaker. This was my opportunity. Once the vibration of the last note had faded, Clive stood quietly for a long moment with his hands folded as if he were soaking in what he'd just heard. He smiled and nodded approvingly. "You know," he said, "I only go into the studio with artists who need my input. Aretha is one of the greatest, but she's not writing her own records, so of course I help her get those records. The same is true with Dion and Whitney, but you're like a Patti Smith," he said. A shiver rose up through me. Was he really comparing me, a 17-year-old newbie, to a songwriting genius? "With Patti," he continued, "I've never stepped foot in the studio once because I don't have to. And that's how I see you. You write your own lyrics. You compose your own songs at the piano. You're the whole package. How do you see yourself?" I stared at him. Before that moment, no one of Clive's stature had ever asked me how I viewed myself as an artist. The question itself served as confirmation that he understood me. He recognized I was a self-contained musician. He knew how important it was for me to define myself, to go into the studio and chart my own course through music's landscape. I'm sure I meandered my way through some long-winded answer to Clive's question, but by the end of our meeting, all